Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. If you commit murder, should you ever have a shot at rehabilitation? Our laws say you should, but in practice, a person sentenced to life with the possibility of parole is more likely to die in prison than be released after decades of serving time. So is that system just? Is it good for society? Those are some of the questions Nancy Mullane takes on in her new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. Welcome, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Holly.
It's good to have you here. And many listeners have heard your excellent documentary, which was on This American Life just last week. Mm. And we'll play a little excerpt of that in a minute. You begin this book with this visit to San Quentin, and you're left alone in a room, and some guys come in, and you realize that you're all alone in a room with a group of murderers. All of the men that are surrounding you are convicted of murderers, and you get really scared. And basically, this book is about confronting these deep fears that you had about what that meant to be a convicted murderer. Can you just talk a little bit about the revelation that you had that day and how it led to this book?
Well, I'm so happy to be here. This is kind of my radio home. KLW is where I've done reports over the years as I've been building this book. My work started in 2007. And actually, it began when KLW had asked me to begin looking into prisons. And so it was the first time I'd ever been inside a prison. Rather than just talk, get an interview with the warden or interviews with legislators, I thought in order to really understand what was happening inside California's prisons, I really needed to get inside. And so it was kind of a revelation, discovering how difficult it is to get inside a prison. I mean, just being a member of the press does not give you automatic access. You have to, A, reach the right person inside the prison who has the warden's ear. Then you have to be approved by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and then you have to get inside the prison. So, you know, it isn't just an automatic step, but it did work out that day. And the public information officer at the time, Eric Messick, met me at the East Gate, walked me into the warden's office. We had about a 20-minute interview with the warden, who at that time was Robert Ayers, and he was wonderful. He said, you know, Nancy, these people who are doing prison time, they made really bad decisions in their lives, but they're going to come back out. And he really impressed on me that, you know, to ask in my work, how do we want them when they come back out? So, and not everybody gets out, but he said many will. And so when I went into the prison through the gate with Lieutenant Messick, and that's into the Sally Port, which is a kind of a locked cage that when you go through one side, you're locked in a cage, and then the other side opens so that no one can just pass through this inner wall. When you step out of the Sally Port and through the other side of this thick wall, you are in the prison with the prisoners and the guards and the guns.
And they inform you that they have a no hostage policy.
That's right. You are told before you go in the first time that if you are taken hostage, they will not trade you for a prisoner. So they will do their best to negotiate your release. And you wonder, well, what is their best? You know, you want to make sure that they're going to try hard if that happens. But in fact, that doesn't happen. But the first time, you don't know. So I was let in. We walked through the Sally Port into this kind of bright, sunny space. And the prison's public information officer's cell phone went off, and he got a call and said, I have to go take this, led me. He said, you can just wait here in this little room. And that's when I found myself in this room. These men opened the door and walked in. And so there were six of them in the room with me, and our knees were, it was such a small room that our knees were touching. And I just really thought at that moment, okay, so who are people who commit murder 10, 20 years after they've been sent to prison? And I just had
But you had some real fear at the time. You had some of the kind of common misconceptions that people have.
I was terrified. I thought, you know, and immediately the thought came to me, we keep people inside who commit a murder because if they get out, they're going to want to do it again. There's going to be this thing, once a murderer, always a murderer, that saying in your head. And that saying was what was spinning inside me. And I really thought they were talking about things, but I thought they were talking in code about you're going to grab her and then I'm going to. I just thought they're just going to want to kill me. And I actually kept thinking my husband, my daughter. But the most amazing thing happened. They reached their hands out to me to say hello. And they wanted to talk. And one of them got up to get me a glass of water because he thought I looked rather desperately pale. And that began this question, which has really driven my work. And every time I tried to find the answer, it wasn't available. It wasn't available in the media. It wasn't available in the through the legislation. It wasn't available to war. It wasn't.
And is that question, how do we want these people to rejoin society? What is that
the
central question?
The question is, when we send someone to prison for committing murder, who are they 10, 20, 30 years later? Who do people who've committed the worst? I think there's probably no other crime worse than killing someone. And who do they become?
Well, and we've got Jesse Reed is here with us, and he was convicted of first-degree murder in 1985, spent nearly 25 years in prison, and was released in June of 2009. He now lives in Oakland, and thank you for joining us, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the things that I noticed, I was at a recent reading of this book, and all five of you were, Jesse and Philip and Richie and Eddie and everybody who was in the book, Dawn, were there, and each of you, when you got up to speak, started by acknowledging that you did a terrible, terrible thing, and that you're tremendously sorry for the pain that you caused these other families.
Right.
I mean, each one of you very heartfeltly said that. What does redemption mean to you? What does that word mean?
Redemption to me is to be basically restored, forgiven. It's about forgiveness. It's about being restored to a place where you're given an opportunity to show that change has occurred, right? And in a lot of cases, as human beings, we, because of things we've been told or we've learned through our life, we have a problem with allowing people second chances, you know. And it's unfortunately, with the crimes that we committed, we didn't allow the other person to have a second chance. But then in the end, some will say, well, how do you want to, how?
So what gives you
deserve,
the right? Yeah.
Right. It gives you the right to want a second chance. Well, you know, as human beings, and you kept asking the question about, you know, how do you want them to return? You know, how do we want people to return to society? Because like Robert Harris said, these guys are coming back out, most of them, you know, not all of them, but most of them will return to society. And as a society, what type of people do we want back into society, in our society? And are we willing as a people to give them a second chance, or are we willing to just throw them to the side? Okay, well, they're coming back to society, but we're going to push them off into this corner. We're not going to give them a chance. We're not going to give them a job. We're going to make life as hard for them as we possibly can. What are they going to do?
And I just want to give a little context for our audience. Between 2000 and 2009, 57,000 men and women, mostly men, convicted of murder were released from state and federal prison. So this is a lot of people. And so Nancy's question of what is a person who committed murder like 20, 10 years, 30 years later? You've lived this question. What's your answer?
My answer to that is change. In most cases, men who have been sentenced to a large amount of time spend a lot of time with rehabilitation. And rehabilitation is something that is within each individual. It's not about the programs that are there. The person has to be willing to take advantage of the programs that are there. So the change initially has to happen within that person, that person has to make up in their mind, in their heart, that, hey, I want to do things different. You know, I don't want to be the same person.
And did it take a while for you to come to that conclusion? I mean, were you a very different man when you went to prison as a very young man?
Well, I realized the seriousness of the situation I found myself in. Initially, by the time I got to San Quentin and went through the process of entering into the system, at the time, Vacaville was like the reception center. And I went through that process, and by the time I got to San Quentin, I realized, man, I really messed up, you know, and I have to be here for a period of time. However, I don't want to leave here the way that I came in, right? And so at that point, when you're going through orientation and they're deciding you have to go to see a counselor and, you know, and they set a program for you. At that time, I decided that I want to do things different. And to start, what are they offering? You know, what is the future? So for me, it was, you know, computers were the future. And so they had an electronic data processing program there. And so I decided to get into that, you know, and learn how to program computers. And I did. And that process helped me to begin this cycle of change.
And that's Jesse Reed. He's with us on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with Nancy Mullane, who's the author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And Jesse is one of the men that's profiled in this book. And I just wanted to let people know a sort of statistic I got out of your book that's particularly telling. Of the 1,000 prisoners paroled by the state of California in the past 21 years who had served a sentence of life with the possibility of parole for murder, not one has committed a murder again. So there's zero recidivism rate for murder.
That's right. And that actually, that statistic was not an easy statistic to find. I thought if I asked the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation that runs the state's 33 prisons, that they would have that number. But they didn't. It took 3 years of filing numerous Public Records Act requests with the state of California to actually secure that number. And one of the other things we discovered through Public Records Act requests was that if you are serving life with the possibility of parole in California for murder, you have a greater chance of dying in prison if you're waiting for parole than getting parole. Because in California, we have a process that even after you've served, for second-degree murder, it's 15 years. For first-degree murder, 25 years. You automatically are eligible to go before the parole board. When you go before the parole board, usually numerous times, you are not found suitable. But if you are found suitable, which averages between 4 and 12% depending on the year, the governor then has 150 days to decide whether or not to allow that decision to stand. And over the last 23 years, since the voters of California gave the governor that authority, and the governors have been reversing between 75 and 99% of all suitable parole findings or decisions. So the result of that is that even if you are sent to prison with the possibility of parole for a murder, you will have a greater chance of dying in prison than getting out.
Even if you serve out your full sentence.
Even if you serve out the entire sentence.
So basically, the parole process was really politicized, and governors didn't want to take a chance on paroling a murderer and then having that person commit a crime again.
Yeah, no governor wanted to be the next Willie Horton governor. Right. And that was based on a man named Willie Horton in 1988.
So we'll talk about this a little bit more
soon.
And I want to play some of the tape from your This American Life piece and some tape that we have of you interviewing Jesse when he was inside of San Quentin. But just for the clarity for our audience, can you just tell us the difference? So there are people who are serving life without the possibility of parole, so they can never be released. And then there are people who are serving life with the possibility of parole.
That's right. There actually are four different sentences, basic sentences in the state of California. One is a determinate sentence. And this is an interesting sentence. It means that when you have committed any felony other than a murder offense, you are given a determined sentence. So when the day you walk into prison, you know what day you're getting out. And that's called a determinate sentence. Prior to 1976 in California, every felony was an indeterminate sentence, meaning you had to go before parole board and show that you had changed, that you were no longer a threat to public safety. But in 1976, that changed.
That changed. And one of the things that you point out in this book is that it's the people who are being regularly released who are often much more dangerous to society, the ones who don't have to go through the parole board. And you say it's the 120,000 prisoners serving determinate sentences who are released from the state's prisons each year with $200 who are creating the public safety concern.
That's right. So there's this determinate sentencing law that was signed into law in 1976. Jerry Brown signed it in under his first term as governor, and he has in fact said that this was the worst legislation he's ever signed. So this has been a failure in many ways, because we send someone to prison, we ask, and in fact the legislature has stopped funding a lot of rehabilitation programs in the state of California because they say, well, it's not about rehabilitation for 80% of the prisoners. It's about punishment. So it's very difficult. I mean, so we have this problem. So that's the first sentencing policy, is determinate sentencing. That represents 80% of all people sentenced to California prisons get a determined sentence. They're there. They get out. $200 in their pocket, between a 65% and 80% recidivism rate. In fact, in 2009 alone, of that population, when they got out, 146 committed murder in the state of California in 1 year after serving a determinate sentence. So then we have life with the possibility of parole, and that's for people who have committed a murder offense. After they've served their standard 15 to 25, they automatically go before the parole board. Then there's another sentence. That's life without the possibility of parole. And if you get that sentence, you never get out of prison. And the last sentence is the death sentence. And right now, I guess the California voters are going to be considering whether or not to repeal that in November.
And that's Nancy Mullane. She's the author of Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. We're also joined by Jesse Reed, who's one of the men profiled in Nancy's book. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'd like to play a bit of tape that Nancy, it's an interview that Nancy did with Jesse before he was released while you're in San Quentin, and you're out on the yard. And I think you asked Jesse about his crime. So let's hear that.
I was doing a lot of drugs, you know, I was smoking cocaine and snorting heroin and drinking a lot. And we ran out of money, you know, and I started using my product, the stuff that I was selling, started using that. And, you know, I ran out of money one night and decided to go and do a robbery. And saw this guy who was soliciting a prostitute. You know, he looked it seemed to be an easy target, you know, and everything went bad. Everything went bad. I had a .22 revolver that I had gotten from a friend earlier that day, and unbeknownst to me, the gun was faulty, and when I pulled a gun on him, I didn't know that if you pull the hammer back on the gun, that the littlest movement it would fire. And I opened the car door and pointed the gun at him, and I cocked the hammer back on the gun to scare him, you know, and in the process of him reaching, trying to give me the money, the gun went off. I just ran. And a week later, I was arrested for this crime. I didn't know that the guy had died. My sister was reading the newspaper, and she saw that a guy had gotten shot. And when she told me about it, that it was in the newspaper, I just laid on the floor in the living room that day, that whole day. I didn't even come out. It was sickening. sickening, you know, that I had taken someone's life.
And that's Jesse Reed talking about the crime that he committed. That was about a year before he was released, which was in 2009. What's it like for you to hear that, Jesse? What's it like to talk about that?
Well, it's really hard to talk about that. Every time you talk about it, it brings back emotions, stirs up feelings that you try to bury, you try to put away, you try to try and forget about, you know. You know, any person in there that is a caring individual who has a conscience, and I think we all do as human beings, most of us anyway, to hurt somebody, to take someone's life is a terrible thing. It's something that you live with for the rest of your life. And we try and just put it away and not think about it as much as you possibly can. However, there's times when you do. And it's really hard to deal with, you know, because like I said, it stirs up emotions. It stirs up feelings that, you know, it's like taking you back to that night again, you know what I mean, and reliving that whole thing and the whole process all over again. And that can be somewhat disturbing.
Nancy writes about these victim healing circles that I think you've participated in. Can you just talk to us about that? First, explain what they are.
Well, there's one particular group here in San Francisco, the Healing Circle. They started coming into San Quentin through a program called No More Tears. And many of us had gotten involved in that program there. And for us, it was a way, just hearing the stories from the victims themselves. It's not a lot of time where you get an opportunity to hear from the people who have really been affected by the crimes, the type of crimes that we committed. And so hearing these people's point of view gives you a different insight. You know, we know what we're feeling, what we're going through, but not really have an opportunity to talk with people who have been deeply affected by the crimes that we committed. And so hearing from them gave us a different insight. And for us, it was a way, I know for me, it was a way to give back. You know, maybe in some kind of way I can say something to help alleviate this person's pain, you know, or help them to understand more.
And he's talking about the victims' healing circles that happen inside of San Quentin, where victims of violent crime are together with people who have committed violent crime in an effort to heal. You just heard from Jesse Reed, and we're also speaking with Nancy Mullane, who's author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. She also covers the prison system for KALW News, and you may have heard her documentary on This American Life last week. We're talking about lifers. Those are people sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. If you've committed a murder, should you ever get out of prison? And what are the costs to society if we continue with the status quo? We also want to invite our callers to join this conversation. We're at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you've ever been inside, we'd like to hear your experience. Can someone who committed a terrible crime be rehabilitated? And what are your public safety concerns? 1-866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW, and we have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that will keep you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as find opportunities to participate in station events. All you have to do is click the email newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we're going to discuss the mass shooting in Colorado and ask how other places around the globe have responded to similar tragedies. What should the public response be? And today, we're talking about Life After Murder, Nancy Mullane's new book, which follows five men who served decades in prison for murders they committed in their teens and 20s. We're also joined by Jesse Reed, and he's one of the men profiled in Nancy Mullane's book. And you can hear her speaking. She'll be at Book Pass in Corte Madera tonight at 7 p.m., along with some of the men profiled in her book. She'll also be at City Arts and Lectures on October 30th, and tickets are going fast for that. You can get them online. And there's also a book and photo exhibit at Alcatraz that starts on August 25th, and that's, again, Nancy Mullane's Life After Murder. And I want to, again, invite our listeners to join our conversation. We're talking about the question of, can someone who committed a terrible crime like murder be rehabilitated? And if you've been a victim of a crime, what was the healing process like for you? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What do you want to understand about our prison system? And if you've been on the inside, what can you tell us about what that's like? Also, what's the purpose of prison? Should we change the way our system works or is supposed to work? 866-798-8255. Or you can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Jesse, I wanted to ask you, I want to get into how you were paroled and what that process was like for you. But one of the questions that I had as I was reading Nancy's book and hearing your story is, how do you keep a 100% clean record for 25 years in prison? How do you do that?
It's not easy. I can say it wasn't easy, that's for sure. However, to keep a clean record, because to be honest, you need a lot of help. And I think that man upstairs, for me, I don't push religion on anyone or anything like that, but for me, the man upstairs helped me a lot. It's not that I didn't do things that I shouldn't have done. I did. I just, I was fortunate in many cases. I didn't do anything like really horrible or anything, but, just breaking little rules, not showing up where I was supposed to be at a certain time. Because in there, you could get what they call a 128, which is a warning for being late to school.
Of that could affect your possibility of ever getting paroled, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. 115s, which is a disciplinary infraction, and they can hurt you really, really bad. No matter how early on in your sentence that they occur, for me, I had like 9 128s that I got early on in my first few years, just being out of bounds or not showing up class on time when I was in the training program. And those things were mentioned at my parole hearing, 24 years later, and it's a hard process. And while when you're in these parole hearings, everything that you've done while you're and from the time you were received is documented in your file and your C file, and they go through it with a fine tooth comb and to see if you are ready to return to society, if you're still a threat to the safety of the public. And
you went before this parole board and they found you suitable for parole. And then, as Nancy said, there's 150 days that the governor has to reverse it. And the governor did reverse yours. What was that like for you?
Well, for me, that was, I guess, I would venture to say that was the hardest time that I did in the whole process, because that the governor can reverse your parole date, and in fact, you have a lot of men that have went before you who have received dates and theirs is reversed. However, you're holding out hope that you will be released, and that talk a lot about hope, and you're holding out for that hope, but But in the back of your mind, you know that the word that it can more than likely is going to be reversed. And so that's agonizing.
So you've got that 150 days of hope, and then you get the notice.
But well, the hope is combined along with agony, because I mean you're deep in the back of your mind. You're really holding out hope, but you're really saying, chances are he's going to take it. You know, he's going to reverse it. And how am I going to deal with that? Do I continue on with my program, or do I just give up? You know, and some people give up, you know, and they stop programming. And then others, you know, we keep going, you know. And you tell yourself, well, maybe they took the date just to see how I'm going to react. And how will I respond to that? And so do I respond in a negative way, or do I respond in a positive way and continue my program? And staying out of trouble and doing the things that I need to do. I just keep going to my self-help programs. Do I continue being productive in this behind these walls?
And that's Jesse Reed. He was convicted of first-degree murder in 1985 and spent nearly 25 years in prison, and was released in June of 2009. We're talking about Nancy Mullane's book, Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. This is Your Call. I'm Holly Krinen. And let's play a little bit from Nancy's documentary that just ran on This American Life. We're going to hear from a man named Donald Kronk, and he just finds out in this clip that he was found suitable for parole, and then it was reversed by the governor.
We're walking down to 371 North, which is Mr. Kronk's cell.
He's here real tight, sir.
Mr. Kronk.
Yes?
How are you?
Well, I don't know. I've been sick to my stomach all day.
Well, here's the word.
Here's the word. But that means... tell because it's too thick. Yeah. I took it away. Yeah, I knew it would be after it didn't come early. Yeah. What can you do, you know? But I thank you for coming by. Nancy, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm disappointed. Very disappointing. But what are you going to do?
And that is an excerpt from Nancy Mullane's documentary, which aired on This American Life last week. And Holly in San Francisco wanted to ask, is there anybody who's trying to change the law that allows governors to reverse parole decisions?
You know, over the years, I've asked legislators, legal affairs secretaries for the governor's office, justices on the Court of Appeals, and there just doesn't seem to be any political interest or will to do any of the legwork that would be required to change this law. The interesting thing is, since Jerry Brown came into office, so there have been 4 governors. There was Duke Majan, then Wilson, then Governor Davis, Governor Schwarzenegger. Those governors reversed the parole board's decision 75% to 99% of the time, as I mentioned before. Since Jerry Brown has come into office, he has only been reversing 17%. So more than 500 individuals serving life sentences with the possibility of parole who have been found suitable since Jerry Brown came to office have been released from prison on parole. So I think this is a really interesting shift in the way the governor's office is approaching that opportunity or that responsibility. And the way his legal affairs secretary has explained it to me, Steve Acquisto, is that the governor sees the parole board's decision as a decision, and that if he is going to reverse it, that he's inserting himself in the process. But the interesting follow-up to that is that, you know, in another 2 years, 2.5 years, Jerry Brown will be potentially no longer the governor. Who is going to come next? How will that process so it remains in the hands of the governor, who's ever in that office.
And that's Nancy Mullane. She's the author of Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. Let's get to some of our callers now. Let's go to Noel in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Hi. My name is Noel. And I was convicted of a gun crime in 1988. I robbed a department store and I shot the female employee that worked there that night in the head. The woman survived. There was actually a fight for the gun after that. And I was given a substantial amount of time as a result of that. I grew up in California Youth Authority. I graduated later on to state prison. And as far as the question of redemption goes, you know, that's a pretty big word. And most of the time I wouldn't feel as though there's much actual application for it in life, you know? Hmm. But what I found is that, you know, I had to change everything about myself. I basically had to create a new person. There wasn't anything about, I enjoy a different life today. You know, I'm married, I've got a career, I've actually got custody of my kids. There's a lot of great things in my life today, and I love the life that I have. You know, but for me, I had to basically recreate a new person. There wasn't anything about the old person that I was that has any value in this world. You know, and part of the trap or part of what I had a hard time with was a lot of the survival skills that you learn that you need when you're in prison have no practical application in this world.
The survival skills that you need in prison have no practical application.
That's true. Now, the thing that's confounding about it is that you absolutely need those things while you're in prison. It's what keeps you alive. You know, so the very thing that has saved your life through all those years in prison now becomes your worst enemy once you hit the other side of the gate, you know?
You know, I'm kind of interested. May I ask you a question?
Hold on, Noel.
I ask you a question, Noel?
Yes.
I'm Nancy Mullane. I wrote Life After Murder. And I'm curious, what's it like on the outside? Do you tell people about your history?
You know, the older I've gotten, the more guarded I become. But I do not have a problem sharing with people. I'm not a secret keeper. There's nothing secretive about the way that I live my life. And, like, I was married about a year ago right now. It took a little while until I, you know, talked with my wife's parents and the other family members about specifically what my past was. But I will tell you. But there needs to be a time where I know that I can trust you with that information.
Noel, thank you so much for calling, and you can stay on the line if you want. I want to ask Jesse about something that you brought up, which is this idea that the survival skills that you need in prison don't help you at all, or in fact, contrary to what you need on the outside. What was it like for you after 25 years of being in prison to get out and try and re-enter? And I know that Jesse, that you struggle. I mean, you're working two jobs. He is a counselor for incarcerated young people for in the Department of Juvenile Justice, and that's what he does during the day. And then he's a janitor by night, and you struggle to make ends meet. But talk to us about that process of going from prison, 25 years, the majority of your life.
Well, for me, I kind of disagree with the survival skills, because for me, survival meant to keep myself busy. And I find myself doing the same thing out here, keeping myself busy through work. You know, in there I programmed. I went to school. I went to church program. I went to self-help programs. I was always busy doing something. And it's funny that, you know, I find myself right here on the outside doing the same thing from sun up to sundown. You know, I'm programming still. You know, I learned to, you learn patience while you're in there. You know, you have no other choice. I think that most of us, we laugh going to work. You know, we carpool to work to Stockton. I work in Stockton. And so we carpool every day. And a lot of times we laugh about the fact that doing time has taught us so much patience, you know, how to wait and not be in such a hurry to gain anything or to, you see people, in the stores, you know, they don't want to wait in line, you know, and everything is fast paced out here, but you know, it's okay to just sit back and wait.
You mentioned something else in the book, which is that you now know how to de-escalate a conflict. Like, you're not the same person that you were in your youth, or these young people that I guess you talked to in the California Youth Authority, that now if somebody sort of challenges your manhood, you know how to walk away.
Right. Well, we teach inside. We teach a curriculum, basically, to these young people. And the program which I work for was started in San Quentin. And it's called Incarcerated Men Putting Away Childish Things. So the acronym is IMPACT, IMPACT. And that, again, that stands for Incarcerated Men Putting Away Childish Things. Keeping in mind that incarceration happens, you know, when you're in prison, you're basically detained, okay? But incarceration happens in the mind way before you get to prison. And one of the things we talk about is if you can't think, you can't win in life. You have to be able to think at all times. And de-escalation of events, we cover that in a couple of different modules that we teach. An essential makeup of a man, where we talk about images versus reality of who we really are. You know, we talk about male role belief system, the things that men grew up believing that is not reality. We also talk about violence, violent prevention, you know, and taking timeouts, stepping away from the conflict so that you'll have an opportunity to think, you know, and by doing that, you give the other person the opportunity to think as well. You know, body signals, recognizing people's body signals and how they're reacting, you know, and if they're getting frustrated or angry, you know, the cycle of violence, how it all works, you know, and
are young people responsive?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. It's surprising and how responsive that they really are. And you know, young people are really like sponges, and they're sucking up knowledge, mm-hmm. you know. And the thing is, what are we putting in them? What do we want to put in them? We want to put we want them to suck up violence or negativity, or do we want them to suck up those things that are positive, you know, and arm them with some information, exchange information with them. They want to learn. They want to do things different. They don't want to. And it's been my experience that most of these kids, they don't want to live the lives that they're living. But it's all they've been taught from the communities that they come from. And they just want someone who's been through it to tell them, hey, you know, it's okay. You know, you can, you don't have to be this way. You don't have to try to prove something to another man. You know, you don't have to put this mask on and pretend to be someone that you're really not. It's okay to be who you are. You know, and if you're a good person, a caring person, then it's okay. You don't have to pretend with your homies, you know, your friends, that you're really some tough guy when you're really not.
That's Jesse Reed. He's one of the men profiled in Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption, which is a new book out by Nancy Mullane. Let me get to Nina in Monterey. We've got a lot of calls, so I'm going to try and get to a few of them right now. Thank you so much for calling, Nina. You there? Nina? Okay, then let's go to Linda in Marin. Hi, Linda. Welcome to your call.
Hi. It's Linda in Santa Cruz, but that's okay. Thank you so much for your book, Nancy. And my question has to do with this divide between the tough-on-crime segment, which is mostly powered by, you know, white middle-class people whose communities are the least impacted by crime, as compared to the communities of color and low-income opportunities where the lives are much more pervaded by crime and criminal justice system's response to it. So I'm curious if you have made direct kind of appeals and or, you know, engagement with or tried to engage that sort of tough on crime segment of our population that really has the media, the press, you know, and it's constantly mm-hmm. talking about closure and, you know, and death penalty and, you know, these kinds of things which give a very false sense of how to heal, how communities actually really do heal from crime.
Well, I think one of the ideas of the book, and, you know, this book has been 5 years in the making. And one of the things that I'm hoping to accomplish with the writing of this book is to humanize the population of individuals. There are over 140,000 people in California living inside our prisons. In the United States, there's over 2.4 million people living in prison. And yet the walls of the prison, as Kim Richmond, a professor at University of San Francisco, said in an interview I did with her, which is in the book, those walls are not high just to keep prisoners in. They're there to keep us out. We really don't have a sense of who people are inside of a prison. And when we send them away, we don't really see them when we don't have that same kind of impression of who they are when they come out. And they've been, you know, it's costing us between $50,000 a year and $200,000 a year to keep someone serving a life sentence in prison.
And with the possibility of
parole. With the possibility of parole. And more if you're serving a death sentence or life without the possibility of parole. So, you know, these are very high numbers. This is costing the state billions of dollars. And yet, do we have any sense of what we're getting back for that investment? And so one of the things I'm hoping is to, A, humanize the individuals who we send behind these walls, and ask them through our policies to live in really cages that are about 7 feet by 4 feet with another man for 20, 30 years. And so to humanize that population and then to give a face to the individuals who come back out.
Do you want to just read a little excerpt from your book there that talks about that?
Oh, this is from the chapter Time and Space, and it actually describes the first time it's very hard to get into a prison. It's even more difficult to get into a cell block. And after I was one of the inmates, in fact, it was Don Kronk, gave me permission to visit his cell, and the prison warden approved that visit. So here it is. Officially, by measurement, a double man cell inside San Quentin's North Block is 44 inches wide. The cell door takes up 24 inches. Inside the cell measures 7 feet, 7 inches high by 4 feet, 6 inches wide wall to wall, by 10 feet 8 inches long. The beds measure 2 feet 6 inches wide by 6 feet 5 inches long. There are 36 inches from the top bunk to the ceiling, and 34 inches from the bottom bunk to the top bunk, and 22 inches from the edge of the bunk to the far wall. "What's this?" I ask, picking up a ball of wire all curled up in a mass. "Stainless steel to clean the sink and toilet," Don says. He pushes his body flush up against the stone wall opposite the bunk so I can squeeze past him to get to the back end of the cell. "There's the toilet and sink. They're all stainless steel," Don says. "This is our bathroom, our sink, our kitchen. We have to do everything in here. If there's a death in the family, we grieve in here together. We celebrate accomplishments or victories, holidays. If you're sick and throwing up and diarrhea, right here with another person. You just have to get over the embarrassment and do it. But it is humiliating. It's all you have."
That's Nancy Mullane reading from her book, Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. We just have a couple of minutes left here. You know, you said you were trying to humanize the prison population for people and for politicians. And our producer, Ali Bednar, asked the question, you know, do tough-on-crime politicians really care who the people are? I mean, is the bottom line really about money, and that's the only reason we're looking at reform right now?
Well, I think one thing that a legislative aide told me at one point was, you know, all you have to do as a legislator in the state of California with term limits is put up that one tough on crime legislation and you're done. You just have to do it once and then you've got it covered. No one wants to appear to be sympathetic or to see the prison population as a human population. They just do the tough on crime and you've got the votes.
And pragmatically, as a population that is reentering society every single day.
Exactly. Absolutely. You know, so I think, you know, the one responsibility that I felt as a member of the press was because I had access to go inside a prison, because I had the opportunity to sit with individuals sitting in these cells, living on the yard, living more than half their lives behind these walls at such an expense to the state. I felt it was a responsibility to tell their stories. And they've, you know, I've often been told that no one getting out like Noel would want somebody to know that they had committed the crime of murder. And yet, because these men met me inside and trusted my work, they were willing to continue to tell me their stories on the outside.
So we literally have just a few seconds left. I'd like to just get final thoughts on what you want listeners to think about as they continue to think about this issue and read your book. Go ahead, Jesse.
I would like to just simply say that, you know, we don't want people to be super sympathetic to, you know, I mean, some people, I mean, we commit crimes and you should be put away. But to understand that living in these little cages as a society, we put animals in kennels and we're outraged about the way that they're treated in those kennels. But yet we'll put human beings in these same type of kennels and say, hey, it's okay because we're being tough on crime. When there are men who are working towards change and become better individuals, better people in society, to contribute to society, let alone, you know, not hurt and harm, that there has to be some way to give these people an opportunity to do just that.
And we're just going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry we don't have more time. That's Jesse Reed, who lives in Oakland, is one of the five men profiled in Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. It's by Nancy Mullane, and she'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 p.m., along with some of the men in the book. She'll also be at City Arts and Lectures October 30th. Tickets are available online. And there's a book and photo exhibit at Alcatraz starting August 25th, and we'll put a link to all of those web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for all the calls. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the recent mass shooting in Colorado and how we should be responding. There have been 60 mass shootings in the United States since January 2011. President Obama believes the solution is in better enforcement of existing gun laws. How have leaders of other nations responded to similar incidents of gun violence? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What could we do as a society to prevent gun violence? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.